Accession number 27747, Reel 1.
Reel 1, Graham Pitt. Graham, could you tell me where and when you were born?
Yes, I was born on the 29th of June 1920 in Wanstead in Essex, which is a suburb, really, of London. My family were comfortably off, not rich, but we didn't want the money. And my father got a car fairly early on, you know, about 1922, I suppose. And I remember cars from 24 onwards, Singers. I went to the St. Joseph's Preparatory School, which was a Roman Catholic school run by nuns. Good discipline and good teaching. I was a Protestant, but I crossed myself with the best of them. But I was a sickly child, and I spent a lot of time away from school. My mother took me in hand and made me write with a pen and ink, which I hated. But I did do a lot of reading, which I think stood me in good stead in afterlife. And then I had quite a salutary experience, because when I was about 8, I went down to a one-horse farm in Kent for the good of my health, where Auntie Gladys, she wasn't an aunt, she was a friend, you know, I called her that because she was a friend, but she was a strict disciplinarian and tried to fatten me up as though I was a calf. And, I started off with 3 slices of bread for my tea and breakfast, gradually worked up to 5 and went down the hill every Friday to be weighed to see how I was getting on. But I did have a bit of an insight into rural life, which has helped me a bit, I think, in understanding modern-day problems. I used to have a go at milking the cow, sitting on an upturned bucket and being sloshed round the ear with a shitty tail. the cows used to be on stakes, so I used to be able to move it, and so that they were in that. This was the idea, was intensive grazing. And occasionally I went and cut down a tree, because we were dependent on the local wood for fuel. And it was used for fence posts and all the rest of it. Friday night was bath night. I used to have my tea in front of a copper where I used to feed little sticks under the copper cauldron. And after it was hot enough, Auntie used to take the hot water into the bathroom in buckets and, you know, scare away the spiders which were floating around. And there we were. Uncle was a schoolmaster at the Monarchs Grammar School in Walthamstow and used to travel up by car 30 miles every day. And they had bought the farm because Cathy was stone deaf. So she could only communicate by signs and lip reading.
That was their daughter?
Yes. But there was a farming strain in the family, so she took to it quite well and did all the work. Perhaps too much hard work, but we used to clear bits of the wood and do double trenching and all the rest of it, but I got quite handy with a mattock. And then, of course, come summer, there was the harvest time. And being a small farm, Uncle did a siding and I followed up behind, you know, raking up the hay into first lines and then humps. And then Dolly, the horse, would come around with the cart, and I would help put the hay on the cart, taking care to use the hay pitchfork properly, because you've got to be careful with the prongs. You pick it up like that, and then turn it like that so that anybody on the cart isn't damaged by the prongs hitting them. I suppose it went to a haystack in the early days, but later on we became frightfully sophisticated and had a Dutch barn, which I helped build. It had a brick foundation, which we had difficulty getting with the corners, and hadn't really thought that you need a quarter brick to get round a corner with a 9-inch wall. But anyway, that was all right, and then the hay went under the Dutch barn.
Why was a Dutch barn different to an English barn?
I don't know. But Dutch barn, do you know if they're just raised on posts with a corrugated iron roof? And everybody always calls it a Dutch barn. I suppose an English barn, yes, well, the English barn would have closed sides, wouldn't it? Yeah. But this is open to the air. Probably better for the hay, I should think, because you have to have your hay properly dried. Otherwise, if it's still hot green when you put it in the stack, it's liable to spontaneously combust. And then, of course, you've had it. Anyway, I don't know that it did me much good, but I had proper schooling again at St. Joseph's from 9 till 10. Then I went to a minor public school, the City of London, which was on the Victoria Embankment. I didn't do very well in the entrance exam, but my brother had been there first, and I think that probably helped. But academically I wasn't at all bad, but physically I was pretty feeble. I got sundry prizes. I got a corporation scholarship when I was 14, and my father very kindly put the school fees in my bank account, which was nice. I went up the modern side, and which specialised in French and German. School certificate, and I got my 7 credits and 2 orals all right, so that gave me matriculation exemption. You required 5 for that, and I think maths, English and the language, well, that was all right. Then I went into the sixth form. I had a bit of a problem there, because I was hoping to get a scholarship to one of the older universities, but I could either go into the modern six, which was run by an absolute tyrant called Wilkinson, who was an absolute martinet, and all this history six, which was run by a chap called Penn, who was a dear but rather gaga. And I thought if anybody was going to drill pit for a scholarship, it would be Wilkinson. So I went into the modern six, but looking back at it, I'm not sure that I made the right decision, because I was good at languages, but I think to get a scholarship you need the extra edge, and I haven't got that feel for language. My wife has, but I haven't. I think I might have done better with history. But on the other hand, the history exam are apparently rather chancy, depending on just who know how the questions happen to go. Now then, while all this was going on, the international situation was worsening. My interest in the Navy started, oddly enough, in about 1927. I hope I'm not boring you to read it.
No,
but
not at all.
There was a film done in the called The Coronel and Falkland Islands Battles. And I remember going with it with my mum to the Rialto Cinema in Leytonstone, seeing this. Then immediately afterwards, I was ill as usual. I had chicken pox and German measles, and I think English measles. So we had got from, I think, my grandfather, a thing called The Times History of the War in 20 volumes. Do you know that one? No. Well, they're quite big books, and, you know, they take about that much. And spurred on by the film, I started leafing through this and looking at all the naval chapters. Then I started drawing the ships, and after that I was lost. My father's secretary later on used to cut out the Times naval column every day. In those days, the Times was a paper of record, and it had some very solid stuff, unlike the flippity-jibbit that it is now. And at the bottom of each day, there were movements of ships. So I had what I called my rub-out book, and I recorded in this book, you know, who was in the home fleet, and who was in the Mediterranean, who was in China, and so on. And this was rather funny, really, because when, of course, Mussolini was beginning to kick over the rails with Abyssinia in 35, and the Mediterranean fleet was much reinforced at that time. The strength of the Mediterranean fleet was a state secret. But if you looked at the movements of ships in the Times, you had it all. You know, the China squadron came across from, oddly enough, China, to the Eastern Mediterranean, and some of the American and West Indies cruisers came across to Gibraltar. And, you know, it was all there. The Italians must have done the same. But one was conscious of the shadows lengthening all the time, and, you know, by about 1937 I thought it was merely a question of how many exams I could pass before the war started.
So where were you in
1937? I was still going up to school every day. I used to travel by the London and North Eastern Railway, which used to be called unkindly the late and never early, but in fact, it was very good. I used to catch the 8:06, and it used to get into platform 19 at Liverpool Street regularly at 8:29. This will make you laugh. When these days you pray for a punctual train, but in those days I prayed for fog so that I could get to school late. But I just walked through to the Circle Line and went round to Blackfriars and along the Victoria Embankment, and there we were. But it was a very good school, because I think being in the capital, you know, you had a more feeling of the outside world than perhaps, you know, as a sequestered one would have, for example, in Devon or somewhere like that. I don't know, Sherborne, I just picked that out of the head. And we travelled up and down every day and saw the world, and, you know, the office girls going to work and the men in their bowler hats and the first class, all the rest of it. So I think it was good for me. Then, of course, we were in Wanstead, and in August 38, my father bought a nice house out of Chigwell, which complicated travelling, because we were then on a branch line to the line that ran from Epping into Liverpool Street. But on the other hand, it was about the last house in suburbia, because we had open fields the other side of the lane. Then, of course, in September, there came Munich. I had no time for Chamberlain. I thought he was a sucker up to the dictators. But Munich, I think, left me slightly confused. Relief that there wasn't going to be a war. And then on the Sunday afterwards, we all went to church to thank God for the peace. And in the second hymn, I thought, my God, what have we done to the Czechs? And there it was. So then I couldn't sing at all after that. Well, then, of course, in March, Hitler had gone into Austria by that time, I think. And then, of course, there came, he got the Sudetenland as a result of Munich. And then in the 1st of March, I was cycling into Wanstead, and I heard on the radio that he'd gone into Poland, which wasn't a surprise, because we had a treaty with Poland by that time. I find it hard to assess Chamberlain, really. I didn't like the man, and whether from the books I've read since, I think probably if we had fought at Munich, it would have been a very near-run thing. But what he did do, and I don't think he's got sufficient credit for this, is that he had tried to make peace with Hitler, and Hitler had let us down over Poland. And it was abundantly clear that you couldn't negotiate with Hitler. So we went into the war as a largely united country. And this, of course, paid off in July, August 40, when we were really had our backs to the wall. So maybe, you know, he was a blessing in disguise, but it's taken me 60 years to feel like that. September 38, I decided I hadn't got the extra edge for a scholarship, although my headmaster seemed to think I was wrong, so I decided to read law at University College London. So I went up to Gower Street every day, just like I'd gone to the City of London for the previous 8 years. I found switching from a sort of arts course to a rather more pedantic legal course a bit tricky, but I think really that suited my cast of mind better. And I got my intermediate all right with 3 seconds and a third. And then, of course, the war started. So the law faculty was evacuated out to Aberystwyth, and some of our lecturers came with us, and we shared joint courses with the Welsh students. This was the first time I'd been away from home properly, and we were in Diggs with Mrs. Jones, a very buxom lady who looked after us. I was with my best friend, so, you know, we didn't lack for company. My father was chairman and managing director of a cosmetic firm, and we felt that there was no future for cosmetics in a war. So I had to be very careful with my money, and I have here a book which shows exactly how I spent my two guineas a week in Aberystwyth. But I never came back on my parents or anything, and I'm pleased about that. A bit smug, if you like. And then in October 1940... I was leaning with my back to a pub wall while my best friend went in to buy some cigarettes, and I saw this bird walking down the other side of the road, and I thought, that's a bit of all right. Anyway, I've been married to her for 58 years.
So you met in Aberystwyth?
Yes, but it took me a long time to get there. I did a bit of rowing, not good at it because I'm not physically strong, and we spent a lot of time on the golf course, but we did work quite hard, and, you know, we had tutorials and lectures, of course, but happily, no exam in June 1940. I think really that year was the sort of the summer term of 1940 was the sunshine period of my life, because I had met Mary then, and we had a bit of jollity, only a little bit. No hanky-panky, of course, in those days. And then in June, it was interesting that quite a number of soldiers came across who had been in Dunkirk and had come to recuperate, if you can put it like that. So they used to sit on the front in the sunshine. But we had some refugee German lecturers, Friedman and, of course, I forget what the other chap's name, Schwarzenberger. And, of course, in May, as soon as the panic started of the fifth column, they were whipped off to the Isle of Man. Happily, my year didn't have either of them, but there was a gap there. And this was had a knock-on effect, because the dean of our faculty said he wasn't going back to bloody Aberystwyth in the way the Welsh police had treated Friedman and Schwarzenberger. So the next year we had a year in Cambridge at the cost-price rates, which was quite good. But so my university career was very unusual in that I went to no less than three buildings over 3 years. I think the Germans do it that way, but of course it's unusual for the British. Now let me think. I quite enjoyed Cambridge. I tried rowing, but my wrists weren't up to feathering for a long period, so I was thrown out of the second late. Took up squash, played badly, too slow, really. But, of course, that was a hard grind that year, because with finals coming up. It was a bit difficult for us, actually. I don't know how other people manage it these days, but we had three subjects in our... well, the second year of our final course. And we had had four subjects in the first year of our final course. So we had to learn the three and keep up with the four. And I didn't find that pretty easy. But anyway...
Where were you staying in Cambridge?
In Diggs, in the New Market Road, a place called Sun Lodge. And that's a funny old thing, because on the first floor they had a ghost. And we used to hear feet tapping along the corridor and realise that there's no one there. Years later, I went to have a look at the site of Sun Lodge, and it had been replaced by the office of the Cambridge Daily Press, I think it was. And I asked the chap on the sentry on duty if he knew anything about the, you know, what had happened to Sun Lodge and all the rest of it, and he said no, he didn't. I said, well, it doesn't matter anyway, it was haunted. And I told him how, and he gave me a very peculiar look, because he said he'd come in the previous day and the person on watch in the warehouse or whatever, which was at the back on the site of Sun Lodge, was sitting at the foot of the stairs white face, saying it was the first time he had heard footsteps in a building which he knew was empty. So, you pay your money and take your choice on that one. But anyway, Anyway, I got my degree all right. It was an upper second, which was a good degree. Yeah. If our conveyancing had been better, it might have been a first, but there we were. The conveyancing wasn't very well taught. That's my cover story. Meanwhile, sort of back in sort of June 1940, I had registered for National Service, and of course I volunteered for the Navy. I had a medical, and it was in the course of the medical that I found that I was in the bloody army. And I was going to be in the Royal Signals, which I believe is quite an intelligent mod, actually, but I don't know about that. I might have learned something about electricity, which might have come in useful. But anyway, I took a poor view of this, and at the Cambridge University, there was some sort of selection board before which you could go, and I think the idea was to select candidates for a commission. For commissions, but I just wanted to get in the Navy, so I applied to go in front of this. And in fact, the board consisted of only one chap, who was Admiral Sir Herbert Richmond. Have you heard of him? In fact, he was quite a knob in those days, one of the sort of theorists behind tactics and strategy and history in the Navy. And it so happened that I'd read Sea Power of the Modern World, so I was able to say, of course, that I had read your books, huh? And that helped, and yeah. I got my recommend for the Navy. Well, then I came down in June 1941, it was just after Russia had come into the war, and I cycled home from Cambridge, seen off by my pal Peter Woodhouse, who died the other day. Aww. And Vivian Herzog, who went on to become President of Israel. You may know that name. He had a flair for public relations, did Vivian, but he was all right. Looking back at it, I think I was quite brave, because all the signposts had been removed. But I had a rough idea, and in fact I got on to the A11. And when I got to Harlow Common, which is now in Potter Street, I got off my bicycle and saw that my friends had put a just married notice on the carrier bag. But anyway, I slogged home to Chigwell and got there in about 4 hours. Well, then, of course, I haven't mentioned the Blitz, have I? In 1940, my brother and I employed the morning of September the 3rd, starting digging a dugout in my parents' garden. And of course, within a quarter of an hour, the air raid siren went. We thought, blimey, it's a bit quick, but in fact, it was a false alarm. But the trouble with Chigwell is that it's honeycombed with underground rules. Yes, and so the people opposite need an air raid shelter, and the people at the foot of the garden need an air raid shelter, and we had the room for it. So they dug out our hole in the ground, which by that time was flooded anyway, and sort of set a concrete box in the ground. And we used to adjourn there on deck chairs to begin with. And then the one family moved away because they didn't like the bombing. And we were able to fit bunks in and get a reasonable night's sleep. But it was a bit chilly because my father had a horror of a bomb falling nearby and the electric somehow or other working inside the dugouts so that we didn't have a light. So we had candles and no bloody heating either. But anyway,
how often did you sleep there?
Oh, every night, as time went on. At that time, the period of the war, of course, the Chigwell was in the outer ring of the London defences, and the other, quarter of a mile from us, there was a heavy ACAC battery with 4.5s, I think, and they used to put up a show. And of course, when the Blitz started, there wasn't a great deal of anti-aircraft fire, but as it was obvious that London was going to be the target for some time, the government brought in a lot of additional AA things, presumably from other areas, and they gave a very good noise. They made a lot of noise. I won't say they did much good, but they encouraged the natives. And we used to have a little mobile AA gun which went up and down the lane outside and did that fire periodically. But all it did, I think, was to cause a crack in one of our walls. But we didn't have much in the way of bombs, because they got lost in the fields, when some of the more frightened Germans dumped their bomb load. But I do remember one whizzing overhead and my mother raising her hands in, fear. And that landed about 250 yards away, I suppose, and shook us a bit. But that was the nearest one. Well, now we better revert to June 1941. I had to sort of hang around waiting to be called up.
Had your family been connected with the Navy in any way?
No. I've often wondered about that. The nearest I can get to it is that my maternal grandfather was chief clerk of the Royal Albert Dock, and I think my uncles were engineering apprentices in some of the works there. Sorry to be so vague, but as far as I know, no one was seagoing at all.
And what was your parents' reaction to being called up?
Well, I think they just accepted it. I suppose my mother was pretty brave, really. Well, I suppose they were pretty brave because they said nothing to indicate undue worry. But, of course, they had been through the First World War, and there were four of their brothers who had gone to the war. One had come back all right, one had come back crippled, and the other two were killed. So, you know, it wasn't really a very pleasing prospect. Mm-hmm. But anyway, my father was... I mentioned a cosmetic firm, didn't I? Which was, in fact, Potter and Moore. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
Yes.
Yeah, it's more or less passed out of sight now, I feel.